Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that would never make ham-fisted puns about the week's news. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
So speaking of hams, the biggest story of the week, obviously, Steve, is eating gammon racist?
That's not what they were talking about.
Is it not? Well, there's lots of things about gammon, and it's a racist term, and...
No. So, gammon is a phrase used to describe, by certain parts of the left, certain parts of the right.
I thought it was a cooked ham.
It is a cooked ham, but there are certain individuals on the right who seem to be very prominent and prevalent on things like Question Time, appearing in the audience, who bear a striking resemblance to a piece of gammon.
A bit like David Cameron when he got angry at PMQs.
Yes, David Cameron would actually be a very good example of gammon.
Is he? I thought he was too young to be a gammon.
Oh, no, he's probably a shoulder of bacon, but... We'll move on.
It is interesting, maybe, that the reaction of many people to their political opponents now isn't to reach out across the political divide or try and understand where they're coming from. It is instead to mock. And that happens on left and right. So we've got snowflakes, we've got centrist dads, melts, and now gammon. But I suppose Whig and Tory were originally insults. So I'm looking forward to hearing about the gammon party playing off against the centrist dad party in 200 years' time.
I feel like the centrist dad party would be the best outcome of that, simply because of all the dad dancing that would occur at the celebration parties and all of the terrible puns.
They have all of the best moves. Speaking of movement, what this episode is about political realignment. It looks like there's been a little bit of a political realignment over the last couple of years. And that's led to a very fixed political situation. And what we're going to try and talk about in this episode is how would left and right try and break out of that? So the last two general elections led to two very, very different outcomes. In 2015, it was a very splintered electorate. Parties like UKIP and the Greens and the SNP picked up loads of votes. That completely changed in 2017, where there was a complete political realignment. There was a change to two-party politics that, in many ways, undid what we'd seen over the previous 30, 40 years. Because what we'd seen since the 1970s was the gradual breakdown of the two-party system and third parties like the Lib Dems or the STP getting more and more votes. And what's happened since the election is that trend's only really been entrenched since. So at the moment, we've got a small Conservative lead in the polls, which must be because of how brilliantly organised their government is being. I can't think of any other reason.
No, I can't either.
Even that small lead isn't really enough for an overall majority. And as we talked about on our local election podcast a couple of weeks ago, the results from that also seem to suggest that no party is really able to win over a lot of voters from the other party. Neither the Labour or the Conservatives is really doing enough to get an overall majority. So it looks like there is a bit of that cultural divide that we've spoken about on previous podcasts really does seem to be entrenching itself and making it harder and harder to win for one party to win over votes from the other side.
Yeah, what's actually quite interesting about this, though, is the fact that when you talk about the cultural divide, it's actually represented in different ways within the Tories and within Labour. So for the Tories, the issue is not so much their leader, but the policies that they are putting forward. Younger generations of Britons do not particularly care for the hostile environment policy, as an example. They are much more liberal on social issues, and as such, they are much less likely to vote Conservative because they see the Conservatives as embodying a strain of political thought on social issues that they just can't find themselves the capacity to support. For Labour, the issue I feel actually comes down to the fact of who their current leader is versus anything else. Labour still haven't been able to make any gains, and I suspect that basically boils down to the fact that they are led by Corbyn, in many ways representative of everything that's wrong with socialism to an awful lot of people in the middle ground of British politics, or of certain generations at least.
Rather than talking about Jeremy Corbyn
again,
let's have a talk about how political realignment might play itself out on the right. So you talked about how the Conservatives had been mentioning Venezuela a lot, and how essentially Jeremy Corbyn's going to put on a beret, turn himself into Hugo Chavez, but he put on another 4 stone in weight and start giving 3-hour speeches. The Centre for Policy Studies put out a report on how the Conservatives can win back those young people that we have now. And Michael Gove gave a speech at that launch in which he said that one of the things that the Tories had to stop doing was banging on about Venezuela, which felt a little bit of an implicit rebuke to a lot of the tactics from Tory central office over the last year or so.
I think what you're seeing from certain parts of the Conservatives is, as you say, the realisation that, you know, we tried all this previously in the 2017 general election, and guess what? It didn't work. So why are we doubling down on this messaging?
But the interesting thing about that Centre for Policy to this report is they've done a series of polls looking at the attitudes of different age groups to how they'd vote for various parties, and also their attitude on the role of government, on the role of tax, all that kind of wonderful stuff. And the striking figure that was reported to the media was that 44% of those 18 to 24-year-olds who were surveyed said that they would definitely not vote for the Conservatives. And I think caused a little bit of alarm in Tory circles, that they, I think, a little bit worried that there's a generation of quite socially liberal young people who are just never going to vote for them.
Yeah, and to be honest, based on their current policy trajectory and what they're currently talking about, they are right to be worried. But it doesn't have to be like that. It's not that they're all socialism-loving lefties who are quite happy, all quite happily don a beret and try and storm Westminster in the name of the revolution. It's that for an awful lot of them, capitalism, they feel, isn't working for them. They can't afford to buy a house. An awful lot of the jobs that they are in aren't particularly well paid. And they're having to scrape by by making rent and food in life. Pension experts are turning around and saying, by the time you're 35, you should have saved double what your salary is, which is absolutely insane. And yet this is the sort of thing which is supposed to be kind of normal and all of that. And so is it really that much of a surprise that they would then turn to someone who says exactly that? Again, listen to the electorate. Okay, maybe Corbyn can't win over baby boomers, but then he doesn't necessarily need to win all of them over.
A striking number of people, only 14% of young people of 18 to 24-year-olds, when asked, agreed with a statement that governments do too much and interfere with in areas of people's lives they should leave alone, whereas 41% of those over 65 thought that governments did too much. And then also you have a majority of those aged 18 to 24 think that it's better when government actively tries to help people at all stages of their life, whether or not they want assistance. So they've got support there for quite an active government. But then, interestingly, you also have a majority of those aged 18 to 24 who say that the government taxes too much and spends too much on services, whereas a majority of those aged over 65 think that the government taxes too little and doesn't spend enough on services. So there's a little bit of a dichotomy there that could be unpacked.
In all likelihood, though, it probably is just down to the standard hypocrisy of any electorate. You know, we all want world-class public services, we all want help, but we don't want to pay for it ourselves. Because ultimately, I suspect if you were to ask that question slightly differently, but put the focus on, say, you know, the top 1% paying more, people would support that much more strongly than what had been put down in that question.
Mm. The other thing I think that's quite interesting, in fact, all age groups generally think that introducing competition is not a good idea, introduces a less good service. But the interesting thing is that's a smaller proportion of those 18 to 24-year-olds think it's a good idea than those aged over 65. Mm-hmm. So you've got more support for competition in public services. Again, all age groups are in favour of nationalisation to some degree, but it's the older generations who are more in favour of nationalisation than the younger generations. The other thing that's interesting is that the younger you are, the more likely you are to think that government should be about providing equality of opportunity rather than equality of outcome. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting, you've almost got a generation of Blair's children, or even Clegg's children, you could say.
Yeah, I was about to say, if you were to try and identify politicians with that kind of viewpoint, it's Tony Blair and it's Nick Clegg, to a lesser extent David Cameron. It is absolutely fascinating that actually the younger groups should, in theory, be very responsive to a message which is much more centrist, but they haven't been. What they've been responsive to is a more left-leaning message from Jeremy Corbyn. And I think ultimately that does boil down to the basic selfishness of individuals. Whilst, you know, it can will be dressed up as my generation isn't doing well, my generation and my friends and me can't get onto the housing ladder, we're all stuck in these low paid jobs, we're not getting the same kind of benefits that generations before us did. Ultimately, that boils down to, I am not getting onto the housing ladder. I and my friends, my social circle, are not progressing in the way that we thought we should. And we're not getting what we deserve.
I'm trying to think how to talk about what you said about the innate selfishness of voters, because it almost makes it sound a bit like a negative thing. What I think is interesting, one of the things that Luke John Davis was talking about in the end of year podcast we did when we look back at the election result, is that we might not see people getting more right wing as they get older for a few reasons. And one of the things that a lot of the post election analysis has found is that actually it's not so much that support for Labour was a youth quake. We've talked a lot about the attitudes of 18 to 24 year olds, but if anything, just saying it's a load of students, a load of young people turning out, is much more complicated than that, because actually I think the something is like 47 and below is the median age. So it's not just about youth. I think it's about the fact that, as LJ said last year, the reasons why people tend to get more right-wing as they get older generally is because they've got a stable job, they've got a home, they've got a stable family, and that isn't being provided for at the moment by the government.
Ultimately, if people have a stake in the system, people are more likely to support that system in one form or another. And I think that's really what's missing for a lot of younger people. And I think that covers everything from like house ownership and home building down to education and funding for various public services, because an awful lot of, for instance, younger individuals are the ones who are seeing exactly what, certainly for the 18 to 24 year olds, they're the ones who saw what the start of austerity looked like in terms of education. They're the ones who have, they've probably been working in and around the NHS, for instance, as I've come out of university, and they can start to see that the system is struggling, and therefore, but by working in those environments and being in those environments, they have that stake. They can see what it is. People who are a bit older, going up to that 47 kind of cut-off period you mentioned, they've got kids, and they're seeing the struggles that are actually happening when they could take their kids to go see the GP, when they're going, when the school is struggling to find all of the funds it needs to provide the resources that's required.
And equally, we'll have parents who will be getting older, maybe requiring some social care, and seeing the problems in that sector as well.
Yeah.
I think the other thing is, and we've talked a little bit about how the attitudes of young people, but the British public generally, attitudes are quite contradictory in terms of tax and spend and the role of government. I think what that mainly proves is it's more about how a politician frames the argument. It's more about how you frame the question, how you present your argument across, what kind of values you're talking about. And one of the things that's interesting about the speeches that Michael Gove have made, Justin Greening made, and Ruth Davidson's going to give one on Monday, which I think will be very, very interesting to look at, is although at the moment you've got those 44% of 18 to 24-year-olds who say they won't vote Conservative, there is a way potentially to win them over. And I think actually someone like Ruth Davidson campaigned quite prominently for Remain, is very socially liberal. If she's successful in Scotland and sees off the SNP, will have a big campaigning oomph behind her. Yeah. she is someone you can definitely see impressing on the national stage in the UK as well.
And actually, even within Westminster itself, there are certain individuals such as Sayid Javid who potentially could make a similar kind of statement as well. It's very difficult to turn around to the son of a bus driver and accuse him of being elitist. It's very difficult to say to him, your policies are racist.
And yet people have tried to criticise Sayid Javid like that, haven't they? There was the notorious Andrew Adonis, I think there was a tweet deleted from his account that was, I think it was some sort of satirical cartoon about how Javid was now going to deport his parents, which was...
It was not in good taste, shall we say.
But I think it does move us on. We've talked a lot about the right and the prospect of realignment there. Let's talk about those socialists that we have now. Matthew Goodwin, who's an academic who's done a lot of research into the rise of the far right in the UK, he's done a lot of published work on the rise of UKIP. He put out an interesting Twitter thread last week talking about the issues that the left has and why people voted for Trump and what that says about how progressives could try and win them over.
On Twitter, Matt Goodwin has been, for quite some time, trying to impress upon his followers what the real cause what the cause is really of the kind of the rise of the far right, the rise the cause of Brexit, the rise of Trump. And ultimately he makes the case that it's all about culture.
So it's stuff like attitudes to immigration, attitudes to the death penalty, attitudes to race, attitudes to homosexuality, attitudes to abortion. It tends to be on those more cultural and social issues rather than economic issues where they're the big divides.
Basically, imagine the stereotypical view of American politics, and that's where we are, broadly speaking, across the entirety of the West right now. Goodwin argues, and I think there's a lot of evidence to support this, that the left is completely missing the point. Every time something like this happens, the left goes, oh, it's all about the economics. It's the economy, stupid. And you can see this now. And I think we've probably been guilty of this as well. We've spent an awful lot of time probably talking about the left behind voters, kind of trying to explain Brexit or the phenomenon of Brexit from the perspective of, oh yeah, these are the people who haven't benefited from globalisation. There's an awful lot of kind of a focus on basically money and economic growth rather than on those cultural themes.
And that was something that certainly Labour under Ed Miliband would always do as well. It was always the, oh, well, people aren't really concerned about immigration. What they're really concerned about is housing. What they're really concerned about is jobs, rather than the actual colour of the skin of the immigrants or the number of immigrants or what have you.
Yeah. You know, as you say, Ed Miliband actually is a classic example of that approach. An acceptance among Miliband's leadership that we needed to have a stance on this that wasn't completely just let everybody in. But at the same time, either they didn't get it or they felt that they couldn't make the point that it was about those sorts of things and that they needed to try and wrap everything up in an economic kind of structural package. Goodwin basically points out that the left's response to all of these things is to go look for Thomas Piketty, political scientist and economist, I think.
French economist.
Yeah, who basically wrote some books about inequality and its impact on everything. And they see everything still through that lens of it's all about the economy, it's all about inequality. And so whenever something tragic happens, like and you know, something terrible happens electorally, they go, right, we need to talk about this, we need to think this through. So who do they go call? The same folks they called last time. And they have the same conversations they had last time. There's probably some small progresses made and in certain areas, but broadly speaking, the language that is being talked isn't the one that's going to resonate with the electorate.
The left has always been made up of a more socially conservative working class plus a liberal class, a liberal intelligentsia. And in fact, this is something that goes back to the founding of the Labour Party in the 1910s, 1920s. Back then, the big cultural issues that often divided the working class from more of the middle class intelligentsia who were running as candidates for Labour at that time was stuff like temperance. I believe Keir Hardie himself was a very strict anti-alcohol campaigner, And a lot of Labour MPs were involved in the temperance movement, which is something that the working class just did not get behind. This isn't necessarily a new thing. If anything, you could argue that the 1950s and 1960s, where class was very much a determinant of who you voted for, that could well be the
anomaly.
Yeah. The question then is, how do left or right try and break out of that?
Yeah, and I think for the left, breaking out of that, it really does boil down to you need to find a way to talk the right sort of language.
Ed Miliband had some really good mugs, actually, that maybe we could reuse.
Ultimately, I think there's one thing which the left needs to just get behind quite massively, and it's really simple and it's really basic. They need to just start talking patriotism again. One of the most important and shocking things when you look at Jeremy Corbyn, Ed Miliband and Gordon Brown versus when Tony Blair was elected was the amount of patriotism that was kind of on display under Blair. Patriotism in and of itself can allow you to present a positive narrative because you can just talk up how great everybody in this country is. It gives you the ability to turn around to say, look, I'm different from all the guys that came before on the left because I get this. And if you can get that on board, you've then removed one of the core reasons people might be suspicious of Labour, especially if you're Jeremy Corbyn. You can then start to go and talk about other things. You can talk about the economy from a patriotic standpoint. You can talk about social housing. You can talk about benefit cuts from a patriotic standpoint. You can talk about the country we want to be much more strongly. And I think you can see bits and pieces of that happening with Sadiq Khan in London, who's been much more leaning into kind of patriotism than an awful lot of his compatriots have actually in Parliament.
Patriotism is often something that is associated with the more kind of blue Labour wing of the party. Hello, LJ, by the way, if you're listening. However, it is something that is used by some of the more Corbynite wing as well. So Billy Bragg, who's one of the celebrity cheerleaders behind Jeremy Corbyn,
yep,
wrote a book about a decade ago now called The Progressive Patriot, in which he puts across this left-wing case for talking in kind of more patriotic terms. People like Lisa Nandy have also been doing some quite nice work, looking at how Labour can try and broaden its appeal in places like small towns and in rural communities where Labour isn't really doing that well compared to how it's doing more in the big cities. And I think if Labour is going, and if the left is going to try and profit from this political realignment, if it is going to try and win over a few of the other more floating voters, it is going to be through some of those approaches. We talked about Ruth Davidson as being someone who might be able to reach over from the Tories into the Labour tribe. Someone like Angela Rayner, I think, could be well placed to do the same.
Again, because of background that she comes from. She is of the left. She is, one, not hard left. Two, she's from a working class background, was a single young mum, and she's relatable in a lot of ways, mm-hmm, to an awful lot of the people that have turned their back on Labour. And if you can show you get it, and you get what people are going through, that's what makes them sit up and pay attention. And that's basically why Jeremy Corbyn is going to struggle moving forward, because all of the people who get Jeremy Corbyn are probably already supporting Jeremy Corbyn.
Do we always have to end every episode?
Yes.
Dumping on Jeremy.
It's a rule now.
Because it means we're never going to break out of our comfort zone of trying to actually get people who like Jeremy to listen to us. We're just going to be stuck with the centrist dads. That is all for this week. We will have an episode out in the week on something or other. If you want to read more from us in the meantime, The Friday Fizz is up on our website, notenoughchampagne.com. We have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. James Cram designed our logo, and Dave Depper is responsible for our theme tune. You can follow me on Twitter at paperbackwriter.
And I'm on Twitter as @acousticradical.
Happy plotting, everyone.